Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Gilbert Marchand. I am counsel for the appellants, who were the plaintiffs below. With us in the courtroom today are the plaintiffs, Suzanne Webble and Ray Beauvais. They were grantees in deeds from the defendants, Darrow. Those deeds contained covenants of warranty, obligating the defendants to defend grantees' title against lawful claims. The covenants did not obligate defendants to defend against unlawful claims. The problem arises when it's not clear whether a third-party adverse claim is lawful or not. Here, plaintiff's title was attacked by the filing of a lawsuit in 1999. Two easement claims were asserted. One, called Lateral A, was never found to be lawful. The other, Lateral B, was first found to be unlawful by the trial court in 2002, 3 years after the litigation had been commenced. Then in 2004, Division 5 of this court reversed and determined that the Lateral B claim was lawful. In both cases, Lateral A and Lateral B, the elements of the subject statute, the critical statute here, Colorado Revised Statutes 38-30-122, in both instances, the elements of that statute were satisfied. The grantees were in possession of the covenanted property. Adverse title litigation was commenced. There was notice to the grantor, and the grantor refused to defend.
All the elements of the statute were satisfied, you say?
Yes, Your Honor.
As of the time of the filing of the lawsuit in 1999?
Yes, Your Honor. The defendants were sued along with the plaintiffs, and the under Siffried v. Knobloch, that gave them notice of the adverse claim, and they refused to defend.
So the claim for breach of warranty existed against the Darrows existed as of the time of the filing of the lawsuit?
No, Your Honor, and a good way to understand that is that with respect to the Lateral A claim, no cause of action for breach of warranty ever arose. That claim was never found to be lawful, and yet the same elements of 38-31-22 were satisfied. At best, as defendants have asserted, at best, the plaintiffs had a contingent cross-claim that they could have asserted at the time of the lawsuit. That's permissive under Colorado Rule of Civil Procedure, Rule 13. There's no authority for the proposition that acquiring the right to bring a merely permissive cross-claim against a party somehow triggers the statute of limitations. Defendants have basically admitted as much because in their response on the Rule 59 motion for amendment of the judgment, they said you could have filed a cross-claim, but the cross-claim couldn't have really been pursued until Division 5 of this court ruled in 2004 that the Lateral B claim was lawful.
Well, let me stop for just a second.
Yes, Your Honor.
The statute says, and the case Burklau, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, says that the time for filing begins to run when these elements of the statute are satisfied. You say they were satisfied here. It says that it starts when the case is filed, when the commenced legal proceedings. Now you're saying, oh, we didn't know when the legal proceedings were commenced whether or not this was a lawful claim.
You
Correct. Don't know until the trial's over with. But there's nothing in the statute where it uses the phraseology, commences legal proceedings, that indicates the claim has to be found lawful or unlawful. Otherwise, wouldn't it have said when legal proceedings are concluded, that's when the time starts to run? Isn't that what you're arguing to us?
Your Honor, what I'm arguing is what is necessary to understand here is what is the nature of a covenant of warranty. If it does not obligate a grantor to defend against an unlawful claim. Burnclough presented an easy case where at the time of the deeds, the third party claimant was actually in possession of the covenanted property, a portion of the property. That constituted an eviction. The Supreme Court said the breach of warranty was triggered by that eviction. The Supreme Court held that 38-30-122 did not apply because the grantee was not in possession. No reported Colorado case has addressed these facts where a third party sues grantees and the elements of 38-31-22 are satisfied, yet the grantees rightfully resist the claim. They're entitled to resist the claim. Otherwise, you'd be making the grantor assume an obligation to defend any claim, whether lawful or not, and that's not the case.
Well, if they were all there in the same lawsuit, you could have filed what you call a contingent cross-claim. It all would have been resolved in one package. Otherwise, what you're proposing suggests that you get to wait until, as however long it takes for that underlying lawsuit to be resolved, and your claim doesn't come into being until that lawsuit's resolved.
With the benefit of hindsight, Your Honor, filing a cross-claim might seem like a more efficient thing to do once you know that the claim is lawful. However, with the benefit of the same hindsight, looking at the lateral A example, which was also asserted against the grantees, it would have been increased costs and unnecessary additional filings of papers to bring a cross-claim. That encourages litigation for no reason. And the grantor can choose not to defend when he gets notice, as the defendants did here. And if the claim turns out to be unlawful, they're not on the hook. In order to prove a breach of warranty claim, you have to prove that the claim is lawful. That is solid Colorado case law going back to Tierney versus Whiting, upheld in Rittmaster versus Rickner. And it's also in black letter law, Amger Second of Covenants at section 66. If the claim is not lawful, the grantor is not obligated to defend. That's the fundamental nature of a covenant of warranty. And in Burncloud, the language that the defendants rely on and that the trial court relied on was dicta. It's not binding on this court. And the reason it was dicta is the court there said, hey, the statute does not apply here, 38-31-22, because the grantee was not in possession. But if it did, meaning if the grantee was in possession there and all the other facts were the same, then the commencement of the litigation would have triggered the statute of limitations.
The grantee was in possession.
Excuse me?
And here the grantee was in possession. So the hypothetical fact that was missing in Burncloud was present here, right?
No, Your Honor. The critical distinction that I urge you to consider is that in Burncloud, the grantee suffered a default judgment. There was no evidence, there was ever any dispute about the lawfulness of the claim. The grantees suffered a default judgment along with the grantors. And in this case, the grantees rightfully resisted the claim, and to the point where they were successful 3 years after the lawsuit was filed.
Mr. Marchand, let me ask you a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Your use of the word lawful is troubling to me. Can we use the word meritorious? Are we saying the same thing? That the claim must be meritorious.
It must result in a valid title interest by the third party claimant. Yes, Your Honor.
So is it your position that if a third party sues the grantee and the warranty says that the grantee has the right to quiet enjoyment, that the grantor does not have an obligation immediately to defend against the third party's lawsuit?
If the grantor is given notice, I think you're giving a hypothetical based on the statute, in possession grantee, adverse title litigation commenced. Grantor gets notice, and then the grantor has a choice to make. He has a gamble to make. If he's asked to defend and he chooses to defend, he has fulfilled part of the obligation he's fulfilled an obligation. If the claim turns out to be lawful, he might be liable for some further damages based on the diminished property value caused by the title defect. If the claim turns out to be unlawful, the grantor paid for the defense of the grantee, thereby conferring a benefit on the grantee, and it turns out in hindsight being 2020 that the grantor could have probably chosen not to defend that, and he would have been off the hook.
Okay, so the quiet enjoyment does not... there's no warranty of quiet enjoyment against a non-meritorious suit, is your position?
Right, Your Honor. And the authority for that is Rittmaster versus Rickner, Court of Appeals case, and also Tierney versus Whiting.
Now, here, if I understand correctly, you're saying that, however, the defendants refused to defend.
Correct.
Was a demand made? Was there a demand and a refusal?
No demand was made. No demand was made under Siefried v. Knobloch. It's clear that by having been joined as defendant in the lawsuit, they were given notice, and at that point, when they refused to defend, they...
When they failed to defend.
When they failed to defend, that constituted a refusal, and defendants have not challenged that.
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Marchand, your position is that a final judgment on that breach, on that claim has to be entered before the duty to defend a lawful claim arises. Isn't that your position?
Before a breach of warranty can arise, Your Honor.
Okay.
Before a breach of warranty, and the reason for that is, and that's in the Foley v. Smith case from Washington and the 95 ALR 2nd 913 article. The reason for that is, which Burncloud didn't raise, where there was no dispute about the legitimacy of the title, whether it was meritorious or not, the claim, is that when it is disputed and when it's not clear, it takes a final outcome from a court to determine whether...
All right. When was the lateral B finally adjudicated against your clients?
In 2004, this Division 5 of this court determined that the lateral B claim was lawful. That became final in 2005.
That didn't become final in the district court until when? 2005?
The Division 5 opinion became final, mandate issued in May of 2005.
That wasn't the final order. It remanded the case back to the district court for more hearings, right?
On the issue of the legitimacy of the lateral B claim, Your Honor, I think under People v. Roybal, it's a final claim.
But the district court didn't decide that claim until sometime later, right?
No, Your Honor. The district court was under remand instructions to determine whether, despite the claim being lawful, whether the grantees here were on notice of the claim, applying an inquiry notice standard. The issue was it was a lawful claim, but was it going to be enforceable against the grantees or not? I'd like to reserve my time if there are no more questions. Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Joseph Adams Culp. I'm appearing on behalf of the defendants, appellees, Arthur and Darlene Darrow, trustees. The plaintiffs have constructed an elaborate argument to justify their failure to bring their warranty claims against these out-of-state defendants until nearly 8 years after the adjoining landowner commenced an action to have the irrigation ditch easements declared. Plaintiff's argument is based on treatises and case law from other states, but none of these authorities, treatises or case law, concerned a statute like the one we have here in Colorado. The statute, 3830.122, is directly applicable to the case and is dispositive. As Judge Richman has noted in his questions, it says no action shall exist on a covenant of warranty until the party menacing possession has commenced legal proceedings. And yes, the plaintiff's argument would require this court to change the word commence to read obtained a final judgment. In further response to Judge Richman's question, when this court reversed the trial court in 2004, that ruling became the law of the case, but it did not become a final judgment. Final judgment was not entered until 2009. As a matter of fact, while the briefing was going on in this case, that last appeal in that title action was finally decided by another division of this court, and I presume that perhaps a final judgment has finally been entered in that case. If plaintiff's position that a final judgment is necessary before there is a claim on warranty, then their claim on warranty didn't arise until 2009, but they filed their lawsuit in 2007. So their own argument is internally inconsistent. If it's a final judgment, then they were too early. If it's something other than that, law of the case or a final decision from this court, that doesn't fit with their argument. The plaintiffs have also admitted that they could have filed a contingent cross-claim in the title action. If they could have filed a contingent cross-claim in the quiet title or in the easement, the easement litigation, the title action, doesn't that mean that they had a claim that they could assert at that time? The statute of limitations statutes provide that a claim arises when the claimant knows or has reason to know that he has a claim. If they had a claim that they could have asserted in 1999, they certainly had knowledge of it because they had been sued by the adjoining landowner. They could have brought that action at that time. There's no other result that can follow but that their claim arose at that time and the statute of limitations began to run. Granted, they might not have been able to get a judgment against the Darrows on their warranty claim until it was determined that the adverse claim was lawful, because we all remember in the bottom of the deed it says we shall warn and defend against all lawful claims, and that's where this lawful language comes from, Your Honor. Meaning that it has a basis. That warrant the grantor has no obligation to defend against a trespasser, for example, only against a lawful claim. The Supreme Court in the Burnclough against Stevens held that the statute means precisely what it says. Burnclough involved a grantee who was not in possession of the land. And the grantee argued that the statute meant that his warranty claim did not accrue until a final judgment was entered. The Supreme Court rejected that argument on two separate bases. Number one, the statute doesn't apply to a grantee who is not in possession. And number two, the statute specifies commencement, not conclusion of the legal proceedings. Two grounds recited in the Supreme Court's opinion, either one of which...
You say there were alternative holdings as opposed to...
Alternative holdings. And either one of them, depending on one's point of view, could be considered dictum.
So even though Judge Sandstead found that it was dicta, you would just say it was an alternative holding?
Judge Sandstead said he thought it was dictum. Judge... I'm sorry, I'm trying to blank on the Chief Judge's name. Judge Balin, yes. Judge Balin, in her order denying the motion to amend, also agreed that it was dictum, but said that nevertheless it's persuasive. And I submit that it wasn't dictum, because either one of those holdings would have been dispositive of the case. You could as easily say that they decided it on the commencement issue and the recitation of the not in possession issue was dictum.
But doesn't it follow that you wouldn't even need to reach the statutory issue if the grantee's not in possession?
Because well, granted, if the grantee's not in possession, you don't have to reach that issue. But it is a requirement of the statute. When the grantee has entered into possession of the property is specifically written into the statute. But yes, you're right, because if the grantee is not in possession and there is someone else in possession under a superior title, that is an eviction, and that gives rise to the claim at the time of conveyance. Here, where the adjoining landowner had to sue to get his easement recognized, that raises the question whether or not at that point the plaintiff knew or had reason to know of a claim on the warranty. And I submit that he clearly must have had reason to know. He had to know because he'd just been sued on the thing. Now, the plaintiff's arguments rest on the premise that they could not have brought an action until some later date. But the fact that they could have brought a cross-claim under Rule 13G, contingent on the outcome of the title case, puts the lie to that argument. They could have asserted a cross-claim in the case, or even in the case of a grantor who hasn't been joined, as the Darrows were. Say the Darrows hadn't been sued by the adjoining landowner in that case. The plaintiffs could have brought them in as a cross-claim defendant under Rule 13H. If they could have brought that claim at that time, the statute of limitations began to run at that time. Plaintiffs have this argument that there's no such thing as a compulsory cross-claim, but that's really beside the point. Further, as a substantive matter, there's no law in Colorado, there's certainly no case law in Colorado, and that holds that a grantee cannot bring his breach of warranty claim until there is a final judgment in the adverse title claim, which is essentially what the plaintiffs are arguing, which again, as I remarked earlier, that's inconsistent with the fact of when they brought their claim. What kind of final judgment do they think is required? And their position has been very fluid on that point. Plaintiff relies on an annotation in 95 ALR 913, puts a great deal of stock in that annotation. But that annotation notes, as all ALR annotations do, that there are a number of different lines of cases that have been decided by the different courts throughout the United States, some which hold that the claim arises as soon as the adverse claim is asserted. Colorado has not decided that, but the plaintiffs argue that, well, gee, you need to follow this Foley case because 12 other states have followed it. None of those states, however, none of the other states addressed in the ALR annotation or in Thompson on in the Thompson Treatise that the plaintiffs also relied on, none of those other states has a statute. So we come back to the statute again, and what does the statute provide? It provides that no claim shall exist until, which has a time connotation. I think the plaintiffs would also like the court to interpret that statute to say no claim shall exist unless an action has been brought by a person menacing possession. But it doesn't say unless. It says until, which implies a time element, that once that element has been met, then the claim exists. Plaintiffs in their briefs argue that Colorado case law is consistent with this foreign case law, such as Foley. They cite the Heard case and the Pagosa Springs investment cases as both as cases where the court held that the claim arose upon final judgment in the adverse or in the title matter.
Mr. Colquhoun, both, I apologize. Let me interrupt you for a minute. Because
certainly.
The statute says, in the end, the statute says, has refused to defend at his own cost the premises in such action. And I can certainly see that the duty to defend would arise upon commencement of the suit. But what about the duty to indemnify? Is there really, can you really sue for indemnification or for damages, if you will, until damages exist? How could you allege that you've been damaged when you've not been damaged yet?
The same way you allege damage in any contingent kind of claim, be it a third-party claim or a cross-claim. I have been sued by the plaintiff. If I am found to be liable to the plaintiff, then you're liable to me. And we do that all the time. That's what Rule 13G and the cross and the counterclaim rule are all about. If it's found that I'm not liable to the plaintiff, then I don't. Then my claim against the co-defendant or the third-party defendant simply never comes into play.
So you're saying that the claim for damages accrues upon the risk of damages rather than upon the fact of damages?
Yes, the fact that we can't determine the amount of damages at the time the claim is commenced doesn't bar anybody from bringing a claim. We see this in all kinds of other contexts as well. Classic example, indemnification, which Your Honor raised. I bring in a third-party defendant who has some sort of duty to indemnify me. I don't know what my damages are until I've suffered a verdict where I'm held liable to the plaintiff, or I've incurred the defense costs in defending against that claim, be it an insurance company or a contractual indemnification or whatever. The two claims go forward hand in hand. In this case, in 2002, the trial court decided there were no easements in either ditch. Part of that judgment would be, therefore, that the cross claim is similarly denied. When this court, another division of this court, reversed as to lateral B, it would also reverse as to the cross claim and send those both back to the trial court for further proceedings.
Thank you.
In both the cases, Heard and Pagosa Springs, those were not cases that have similar facts to ours, because both of those were cases where the claimant was not in possession and the title action that was being discussed there was not by the adverse claimant against the plaintiff in the lawsuit, such as we have here. It was in Heard where the grantee who was unable to enter into possession sued the person who was in possession for eviction. That hadn't been concluded yet. The court said we haven't alleged it. You haven't alleged an eviction. But I think that based on the other, on more recent case law, including Burnclough, clearly that grantee could have sued at that time because he was unable to get possession of the property. The other case, Pagosa Springs Investment against Seavers, the plaintiff tried to allege that he didn't know that he had a title claim, or a warranty claim rather, excuse me, until he got the property back through foreclosure, because it was two or three grantees down the road who had actually suffered the loss of part of the property through a quiet title. And he tried to say, I didn't know about my claim until I got the property back through foreclosure. And the court said, no, you at least had reason to know of your claim back when that occurred. Completely different fact situation. It's simply not analogous to the situation we have here. As I have pointed out, the arguments of the plaintiff would require some significant changes to the language of the statute, which the court cannot make. It would require to change until and to unless, require change commenced to obtain a final judgment, and the court simply cannot do that. Therefore, we request the court to affirm the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. The statute of limitations is 1380-108-6, and it says the cause of action arises when the claimant knows there is a breach or should have discovered that there is a breach. It does not say that the claim arises when the claimant knows that there is a claim, like a contingent cross claim, or should have known that there's a contingent cross claim. That is a critical distinction here, and the facts clearly show that within 3 years of the commencement of the litigation, the grantees could not have known, nor should they have known, since the trial court had just denied all the claims after an 8-day trial, that there was a breach of warranty. The plain language of the statute, I just simply disagree with the trial judge's interpretation and Honorable Mr. Cope. I don't read it as saying that that the time element of unless, what it means is that you can't, if you're an in possession grantee and you get sued, you can't go sue your grantor if you've settled the claim. The purpose of the statute needs to be addressed here, and the Siffried v. Knobloch court in 1908 explained what the purpose of the statute is, and they didn't say it had to do with triggering the statute of limitations. It's to give the grantor an opportunity to decide whether he wants to defend his claim, to defend the title or not, and we had an exchange about what is entailed in that. I think the Burnclough language is clearly dicta, and in the Woods versus Interstate Realty case relied on by Mr. Cope, the Supreme Court there found that there were alternative holdings because each were applicable. In Burnclough, the Supreme Court explicitly said that the statute is not applicable. Therefore, I think the statement that the plaintiffs or that the defendants in the trial court rely on are clearly dicta. Plaintiffs have not made the argument, contrary to defendants' claim, that they could not have brought an action against defendants. Their argument is that since they did not yet know that there was a breach, they did not have to, nor should they have known that they had to under 1380-108-6. The Pagosa Springs case, I agree with counsel that it's different facts. Notably, when the court was determining what to base the knowledge, when they should have discovered the claim, they based it on the trial judge's final judgment determining that the trespass interest was valid. They didn't base it on the mere filing of that statement, and I think that's a persuasive fact that I would ask that Your Honors to consider.
When did your client's claim arise? If it didn't arise in 99, when did it arise?
The earliest it arose is May 2005, Your
and
Honor.
When did you sue?
August 2007.
2 years and 3 months later.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you for your time.
Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted. We will get your written opinion in due course. That concludes the argument docket for the day. Court will be in recess. Bailiff may so announce.
Court will be in recess.